Losing Dave taught me how ludicrous that was. It wasn't possible for me to remind Jeff that he was living with MS. He was aware of that every minute of every day. Even people who have endured the worst suffering often want to talk about it. Merle Saferstein is one of my mom's closest friends and the former education director at the Holocaust Documentation and Education Center in South Florida. She has worked with more than 500 survivors and remembers only one who declined to open up. In my experience, survivors want the opportunity to teach and not be shunned because they went through something unknowable, Merle said. Still, people hesitate to ask questions out of concern that probing will dredge up trauma. To encourage discussion, Merle ran programs that brought survivors together with high school and college students. She notes that when students are offered the chance, questions tumble out. I've heard them inquire, "What did you eat in the concentration camp? Did you still believe in God?" Young girls will often ask, "Did you get your period? What did you do when you did?" These aren't personal questions. They are human questions, Merle told me. Avoiding feelings isn't the same as protecting feelings. Merle recalled going with a young cousin of hers to visit an elderly couple who had clay handprints of two children hanging on their wall. The couple spoke of only one daughter. Merle's young cousin had been told not to mention their daughter who died because it would make the couple sad. Merle hadn't heard this warning, so she asked about the second set of prints. While the cousin looked aghast, the couple spoke warmly and at length about their daughter. They wanted her to be remembered, Merle said. Parents who have suffered the worst loss imaginable often share this sentiment. Author Mitch Carmody said after his 9-year-old son Kelly died from a brain tumor, "Our child dies a second time when no one speaks their name." This is why the Compassionate Friends, one of the largest bereavement organizations in the United States, encourages families to speak openly and frequently about the children they have lost. Avoiding upsetting topics is so common that the practice even has a name. Decades ago, psychologists coined the term "mum effect" for when people avoid sharing bad news. Doctors hold back on telling patients that their prognosis is bleak. Managers wait too long to break the news that people are being fired. My colleague Maxine Williams, head of diversity at Facebook, told me that she believes many people succumb to the mum effect around race. Even after an unarmed black person is killed for reaching over to show a cop his license, white people who have seen the news, who live in these communities, and who sit at the desk next to us at work will often say nothing, Maxine said. For the victim of racism, like the victim of loss, the silence is crippling. The two things we want to know when we're in pain are that we're not crazy to feel the way we do and that we have support. Acting like nothing significant is happening to people who look like us denies us all of that. By staying silent, we often isolate family, friends, and coworkers. Even under ordinary circumstances, being alone with your thoughts can be uncomfortable. In one experiment, a quarter of women and 2/3 of men chose to give themselves painful electric shocks rather than sit in solitude for 15 minutes. Silence can increase suffering. I only felt comfortable bringing up Dave with a small group of family and friends. Some of my other friends and coworkers made it easy for me to open up. Psychologists literally call them openers. Unlike non-question-asking friends, openers ask a lot of questions and listen to the answers without judging. They enjoy learning about and feeling connected to others. Openers can make a big difference in times of crisis, especially for those who are normally reticent. I never would have expected that I'd have trouble sharing. With my close friends, I'm always the one who wants to talk about everything. Do you like him? Is he a good kisser? Not always in that order. At work, I constantly ask for feedback, to the point that I get feedback that I ask for too much feedback. But in grief, I didn't want to dump my problems on others and was unable to mention Dave unless people really pressed. Openers are not always our closest friends. People who have faced adversity tend to express more compassion toward others who are suffering. Writer Anna Quindlen observes that grief is discussed among those of us who recognize in one another a kindred chasm deep in the center of who we are. Military veterans, rape victims, and parents whose children have died all report that the most helpful support usually comes from those who have suffered similar losses. When Holocaust survivors came to the United States, Merle told me, they felt very isolated, so they started bonding with each other. That's why the survivor clubs formed. The only people who really understood were the people who had been through those experiences. I found this to be true. Colin Summers, a friend from Los Angeles, approached me at Dave's funeral. Instead of saying, "I'm sorry for your loss," the first thing out of his mouth was, "My dad died when I was 4. "Oh, good," I blurted in response. Then I quickly added, "I mean, not good. It's just that you turned out great, and that gives me hope for my children." I was embarrassed, but he gave me a hug and said, "I knew what you meant. And I promise your kids are stronger than you know." It wasn't my smoothest social interaction, but it was one of the only moments on that horrible day that made me feel a tiny bit better. I had become a member of a club that no one wants to belong to, a club that I did not even know existed before I joined involuntarily. 9 days after Dave died, I went to my daughter's soccer game and noticed her friend's 70-year-old grandmother, Jo Shepherd, sitting next to an empty chair. Decades before, Jo had also been left to raise 2 small children when her husband died, and I instinctively knew that chair was for me. I sat down, and before we'd said 10 words to each other, I felt completely understood. At a Facebook partner breakfast, a client I'd never met before told me that he had just lost his brother. We wound up sitting in the corner and crying together. Many people who had not experienced loss, even some very close friends, didn't know what to say to me or my kids. Their discomfort being around us was palpable, especially in contrast to our previous ease. As the elephant in the room went unacknowledged, it started acting up, trampling over my relationships. If friends didn't ask how I was doing, did that mean they didn't care? Did they not see the giant muddy footprints and piles of manure? Adam was certain people wanted to talk about it, but they didn't know how. I was less sure. Friends were asking, "How are you?" But I took this as more of a standard greeting than a genuine question. I wanted to scream back, "My husband just died. How do you think I am?" I didn't know how to respond to pleasantries. Aside from that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln? All over the world, there is cultural pressure to conceal negative emotions. In China and Japan, the ideal emotional state is calm and composed. In the United States, we like excitement, OMG, and enthusiasm, LOL. As psychologist David Caruso observes, American culture demands that the answer to the question, "How are you?" is not just good. We need to be awesome. Caruso adds, there's this relentless drive to mask the expression of our true underlying feelings. Admitting that you're having a rough time is almost inappropriate. Anna Quindlen puts it more poetically. Grief, she writes, is a whisper in the world and a clamor within. More than sex, more than faith, even more than its usher death, grief is unspoken. Publicly ignored, except for those moments at the funeral that are over too quickly. The elephant followed me to the office, too. I've always been friendly with my colleagues, especially at Facebook, where our company mission is to make the world more open and connected. Our culture reflects this. All of us sit at open desks where anyone can walk up and talk to anyone else. Conversations, including personal ones, are frequent and public. At first, going back to work provided a bit of a sense of normalcy. Then I quickly discovered that it wasn't business as usual. I have long encouraged people to bring their whole selves to work, but now my whole self was just so freaking sad. As hard as it was to bring up Dave with friends, it seemed even more inappropriate at work. So I did not. And they did not. Most of my interactions felt cold, distant, stilted. Walking around the Facebook campus, I started to feel like a ghost, somehow frightening and invisible at the same time. In the moments when I couldn't take it, I sought refuge with Mark in his conference room. I told him I was worried that my personal connections with our coworkers were slipping away. He understood my fear, but insisted that I was misreading their reactions. He said they wanted to stay close to me, but they did not know what to say. The deep loneliness of my loss was compounded by so many distancing daily interactions that I started to feel worse and worse. I thought about carrying around a stuffed elephant, but I wasn't sure that anyone would get the hint. I knew that people were doing their best. Those who said nothing were trying not to bring on more pain, and those who said the wrong thing were trying to comfort. I saw myself in many of these attempts. They were doing exactly what I had done when I was on the other side. With the best of intentions, if friends were in pain, I had tried to offer optimism and reassurance to minimize their fears. "Yep, I see a gray animal in the room, but that's no elephant. Looks more like a mouse." I now realize that it was just wishful thinking on my part that could make people feel even less understood. The traditional Jewish period of mourning for a spouse lasts 30 days. I was nearing the end of the month when I thought about expressing how I felt on Facebook. I poured my emotions into a post, but didn't think I'd ever share it. It was too personal, too raw, too revealing. Finally, I decided it was unlikely to make things worse, and maybe it would make them a bit better. Early the next morning, before I could change my mind, I hit post. My message began by describing the void and how easy it was to get sucked in. I said that for the first time ever, I understood the power of the prayer, "Let me not die while I am still alive." Grasping for a lifeline, I wrote about how I wanted to choose meaning over emptiness. I thanked my family and friends who had helped me through those incomprehensible first weeks. Then I did what proved so difficult to do with friends and colleagues face to face. I described how a casual greeting like, "How are you?" hurt because it didn't acknowledge that anything out of the ordinary had happened. I pointed out that if people instead asked, "How are you today?" it showed that they were aware that I was struggling to get through each day. The impact of my post was immediate. Friends, neighbors, and colleagues started talking about the elephant. Emails poured in with messages like, "I know it must be really hard. I have been thinking about you and your kids." The responses from strangers around the world made me feel less isolated, too. A new mother wrote from a hospital neonatal intensive care unit that she'd lost one of her newborn twins and sought the strength to give the surviving twin an amazing life. A young man shared his wedding photo the day before what would have been his third anniversary. His late wife had changed his world, and he promised that, in her memory, he would help women succeed in his male-dominated field. Strangers comforted each other. To the mother who lost her newborn twin, a woman who'd experienced the same thing offered solace. To the young widower, dozens of people wrote messages of encouragement. And in many cases, friends commented to friends that they had not known about their losses and wanted to be there to support them. Some offered compassion. Others shared personal stories. But the message was clear. As one man wrote, "Even though option A was gone for so many of us, we were not alone." Not everyone feels comfortable talking openly about personal tragedy. We all make our own choices about when and where and if we want to express our feelings. Still, there's powerful evidence that opening up about traumatic events can improve mental and physical health. Speaking to a friend or family member often helps people understand their own emotions and feel understood. After my post, one welcome change was that people began asking, "How are you today?" which became a shorthand way to express empathy. That question also helped me realize that my all-encompassing grief might not be permanent. Adam pointed out that I would often answer, "How are you?" with "Fine." And that didn't encourage people to ask further questions. He said if I wanted others to be more open with me, I needed to be more open with them. I started responding more frankly. "I'm not fine, and it's nice to be able to be honest about that with you." I learned that even small things could let people know that I needed help. When they hugged me hello, if I hugged them just a bit tighter, they understood that I was not okay. With a few of my non-question-asking friends, I addressed our situation directly. I gathered my courage and told them, usually through tears, that when they didn't ask, I sometimes felt like they didn't care. I was grateful that they all reacted with kindness, saying they appreciated my speaking up, and they started asking more questions. Just like I had with Dave's college roommate, Jeff, they had been inquiring, "How are you?" with a genuine desire to connect. But I hadn't given a true response, and they didn't feel comfortable pushing for one. I finally figured out that since the elephant was following me around, I could take the first step in acknowledging its existence. At work, I told my closest colleagues that they could ask me questions, any questions, and they could talk about how they felt, too. One colleague said he was paralyzed when I was around, worried he might say the wrong thing. Another admitted she'd been driving by my house frequently, not sure if she should knock on the door. Once I told her that I wanted to talk to her, she finally rang the doorbell and came inside. I was happy to see her, and not just because she brought Starbucks. There were times I wanted to avoid real conversations. In front of my son and daughter. Right before a meeting. What worked best for me was when people said, "I'm here if you ever want to talk, like now, or later, or in the middle of the night, whatever would help you." Instead of making assumptions about whether or not someone wants to talk, it's best to offer an opening and see if they take it. Death is not the only kind of adversity that summons the elephant. Anything that reminds us of the possibility of loss can leave us at a loss for words. Financial difficulties, divorce, unemployment, rape, addiction, incarceration, illness. Adam told me that 10 years ago, the day before he and his wife Allison were supposed to move to England for a fellowship, she had a miscarriage. They considered canceling their plans, but thought that a change of scenery might be a good way to heal. Because of the distance and their fear of burdening others, they didn't tell friends and family about the miscarriage, or the second one that followed. It was then that Allison, who has a background in psychiatry, taught Adam that when something terrible happens, it can be important to consider how things could be worse. They remembered that a close friend had 7 miscarriages before having healthy children. They thought about how losses later in pregnancy can be far more devastating. When they returned home, the pain was less raw and it was easier to talk about. Allison started sharing her experiences with her friends and found out that several of them had suffered the same loss but never said a word either. Speaking up can strengthen social bonds, but in some cases, it's risky. Having been one of the few Filipinos on his college campus, Anthony Ocampo described to us how he felt the pressure of the American dream to be the representative of the people in our community. He was also carrying an additional weight that he kept to himself. For the hardcore Catholic Filipino immigrants that my parents were, having a gay son was never part of the plan. Anthony became a sociology professor and studied the challenges of coming out in immigrant families. He conducted interviews and learned about a Filipino teenager who drank from a cup and then watched his mother throw it away because she thought it was dirty. When another immigrant son came out to his family, they drove him to Mexico and took away his passport so he could learn to be a man. Anthony saw the paradox of immigrant parents knowing the pain of exclusion, yet inflicting the same pain on their LGBTQ children. When Anthony finally told his parents he was gay, he also shared with them the research he'd done on the damage caused when families turn away from their own. The children look for acceptance in drugs, alcohol, and unsafe sex, he told them. They remember it for years, and it affects pretty much every aspect of their lives. With Anthony's thoughtful and patient encouragement, his parents were able to accept him. Now they include Anthony's partner in their holiday celebrations. Breaking the silence brought them closer together. Cancer is another forbidden or whisper topic. I read about a writer named Emily McDowell who said the worst part of being diagnosed with lymphoma wasn't feeling sick from chemo or losing her hair. It was the loneliness and isolation I felt when many of my close friends and family members disappeared because they didn't know what to say or said the absolute wrong thing without realizing it. In response, Emily created empathy cards. I love them all, but these two are my favorites, making me want to laugh and cry simultaneously. Card number one. When life gives you lemons, I won't tell you a story about my cousin's friend who died of lemons. Card number two. I'm really sorry I haven't been in touch. I didn't know what to say. When I first read Emily's cards, I thought back to a friend with late-stage cancer telling me that for him, the worst thing people could say was, "It's gonna be okay." He said the terrified voice in his head would wonder, "How do you know it is going to be okay? Don't you understand that I might die?" I remembered the year before Dave died when a friend of mine was diagnosed with cancer. At the time, I thought the best way to offer comfort was to assure her, "You'll be okay. I just know it." Then I dropped the subject for weeks, thinking she would raise it again if she wanted to. I meant well then, but I know better now. Recently, a work colleague was diagnosed with cancer, and I handled it differently. I told her, "I know you don't know yet what will happen, and neither do I. But you won't go through this alone. I will be there with you every step of the way." By saying this, I acknowledged that she was in a stressful and scary situation. I then continued to check in with her regularly. Sometimes, despite the best intentions, we still get it wrong. ABC News anchor Diane Sawyer had just returned to work after her husband Mike Nichols died. Diane was riding up an escalator when a colleague on the way down shouted out, "Sorry for your loss!" On the plus side, they were moving in opposite directions, so she didn't have to respond. When you're faced with tragedy, you usually find that you're no longer surrounded by people. You're surrounded by platitudes. So what do we offer instead of "everything happens for a reason"? Asks writer Tim Lawrence. He suggests that the most powerful thing you can do is acknowledge. To literally say the words, "I acknowledge your pain. I'm here with you." Until we acknowledge it, the elephant is always there. By ignoring it, those who are grieving isolate themselves, and those who could offer comfort create distance instead. Both sides need to reach out. Speaking with empathy and honesty is a good place to start. You can't wish the elephant away, but you can say, "I see it. I see your suffering, and I care about you." Ideally, not shouted from an escalator. Chapter 3. The Platinum Rule of Friendship. One August morning during Adam's first semester teaching in Philadelphia, a student lumbered into his classroom. At 6'2" and 240 pounds, Owen Thomas had been recruited to play defensive lineman on the University of Pennsylvania football team. But size wasn't the only thing that made Owen instantly command attention. His hair was so orange that from a distance it looked like his head was on fire. Adam would have noticed Owen even if he'd sat in the back row, but he sat right in front, always arriving early and asking insightful questions. Owen made each of his classmates feel welcome, introducing himself with a friendly grin. During a unit on negotiations, students divided into pairs to buy or sell a fictional business. Owen finished with the worst results in the class. He couldn't bear to take even a dime of hypothetical money that he didn't need, so he practically gave his business away. In December, when his classmates voted on who was the most cooperative negotiator, Owen won in a landslide. In April, he died by suicide. Just 2 months earlier, Owen had stopped by Adam's office to ask for help. Owen was always upbeat, but that day he seemed anxious. He said he was looking for an internship, and Adam offered to make a few introductions. Owen never followed up, and that was the last time they spoke. Looking back on that meeting, Adam felt that he had failed when it mattered most. After the funeral, Adam went home and asked his wife Allison if he should quit teaching. An autopsy revealed that Owen's brain showed sign of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, a disease believed to be caused in part by repeated hits to the head. CTE has been linked to severe depression and implicated in the suicides of a number of football players. At the time of his death, Owen was the youngest player to be diagnosed and the first with no history of concussions. After learning about the CTE diagnosis, Adam blamed himself less for missing the warning signs of mental illness and started thinking about ways to give more support to students who were struggling. But with hundreds of new students each fall, Adam needed a way to make a personal connection with many people at once. He drew his inspiration from a burst of noise. In classic experiments on stress, people performed tasks that required concentration, like solving puzzles, while being blasted at random intervals with uncomfortably loud sounds. They started sweating and their heart rates and blood pressure climbed. They struggled to focus and made mistakes. Many got so frustrated that they gave up. Searching for a way to reduce anxiety, researchers gave some of the participants an escape. If the noise became too unpleasant, they could press a button and make it stop. Sure enough, the button allowed them to stay calmer, make fewer mistakes, and show less irritation. That's not surprising, but here's what is. None of the participants actually pressed the button. Stopping the noise didn't make the difference. Knowing they could stop the noise did. The button gave them a sense of control and allowed them to endure the stress. When people are in pain, they need a button. After Owen's suicide, Adam started writing his cell phone number on the board on the first day of his undergraduate class. He lets his students know that if they need him, they can call at any hour. Students use the number infrequently, but along with the mental health resources available on campus, this gives them each an extra button. When people close to us face adversity, how do we give them a button to press? While it seems obvious that friends want to support friends going through a crisis, there are barriers that block us. There are two different emotional responses to the pain of others. Empathy, which motivates us to help, and distress, which motivates us to avoid. Writer Alan Rucker observed both reactions after being suddenly paralyzed by a rare disorder. As some friends checked in daily with deli sandwiches, the complete films of Alfred Hitchcock, he wrote, or just kindness, others were curiously absent. It was my first indication that my new condition could breed fear in people other than myself. For some, his physical paralysis triggered emotional paralysis. When we hear that someone we care about has lost a job, started chemo, or is going through a divorce, our first impulse is usually, I should reach out. Then right after that impulse, doubts often flood our mind. What if I say the wrong thing? What if talking about it makes her feel self-conscious? What if I'm overstepping? Once raised, these doubts are followed by excuses like, he has so many friends and we're not that close. Or, she must be so busy, I don't want to bother her. We put off calling or offering help until we feel guilty that we didn't do it sooner. And then it feels too late. A woman I know lost her husband to cancer in her 50s. Before this tragedy, she used to speak to one of her friends every week. Then suddenly, the calls stopped. Almost a year later, the widow picked up the phone. "Why haven't I heard from you?" she asked. "Oh," explained her friend, I wanted to wait until you felt better. Her friend didn't understand that withholding comfort actually added to the pain. Alicia Bennett was on the receiving end of the distress response when she needed comfort most. In high school, Alicia ran a local chapter of a nonprofit to fight poverty in Africa, and she arrived at college eager to continue this mission. She contacted an administrator involved with nonprofits on campus, who came to her dorm room to discuss the program. When he discovered that Alicia was alone, he raped her. In the painful aftermath, Alicia grappled with depression and reached out to her closest college friend. "Before, we were inseparable," Alicia told us. "But when she found out about the rape, she said, 'I can't talk to you.'" Alicia sought support from other friends and got similar responses. One of them even admitted, "I know this has been really hard for you, but it has also been really hard for me." The friend was feeling guilty for failing to stop the assault and was personalizing the tragedy. Alicia reassured her that she wasn't to blame. But the friend stopped talking to Alicia, choosing escape over empathy. "The assault was obviously shocking for me," Alicia said. "When I decided to report it, there was a lot of tension. It was a pretty affluent community, mainly rich and mainly white. Being black, I felt intimidated. But just as shocking was the response of my friends. I felt helpless." Luckily, her friends from high school stepped up, and she was able to transfer to a different college and move into an apartment with new roommates who helped her recover. Alicia shared her story on the Lean In Community website in the hopes of encouraging other rape survivors to speak out. She wrote that she was determined to pursue her original goals, and she succeeded, graduating from college and getting a job she loves in Middle Eastern affairs and security. For friends who turn away in times of difficulty, putting distance between themselves and emotional pain feels like self-preservation. These are the people who see someone drowning in sorrow and then worry, perhaps subconsciously, that they will be dragged under too. Others get overwhelmed by a sense of helplessness. They feel there's nothing they can say or do to make things better, so they choose to say and do nothing. But what we learn from the stress experiment is that the button didn't need to stop the noise to relieve the pressure. Simply showing up for a friend can make a huge difference. I was lucky to be surrounded by loved ones who not only showed up but often figured out what I needed before I knew myself. For the first month, my mom stayed to help me take care of my son and daughter, and take care of me. At the end of each endless day, my mom lay down next to me and held me until I cried myself to sleep. I never asked her to do it. She just did. The day she left, my sister Michelle took her place. For the next 4 months, Michelle came over multiple nights each week, and when she couldn't, she made sure a friend filled in. Needing that much help was awful for me, but just entering the bedroom that I used to share with Dave made me feel like someone had knocked the wind out of me. Bedtime became the symbol of all that had changed. The grief and anxiety built throughout the day to that moment when I knew I'd have to crawl, and I mean crawl, into bed alone. By showing up night after night and making it clear that they would always be there when I needed them, my family and friends were my button. My closest friends and family convinced me that they truly wanted to help, which made me feel like less of a burden. Every time I told Michelle to go home, she insisted that she wouldn't be able to rest unless she knew I was asleep. My brother David called me from Houston every single day for more than 6 months. When I thanked him, he said that he was doing it for himself because the only time he felt okay was when he was talking to me. I learned that at times caring means that when someone is hurting, you cannot imagine being anywhere else. This constant support was vital for me, but might not be for everyone. A woman who also lost her husband shared that at first she dreaded being alone at night. Her mother stayed with her for 2 weeks, and then she went to her brother's. She deeply appreciated all the help, but admitted, "After a month, I was so ready to just be alone." It's hard to understand, or even imagine, another person's pain. When we're not in a physically or emotionally intense state, we underestimate its impact. In one experiment, people were asked to put their arm in a bucket of water and guess how painful it would be to sit in a freezing room for 5 hours. When the bucket was filled with ice water, they predicted that sitting in the room would be 14% more painful than when the bucket was filled with warm water. But when people made their predictions just 10 minutes after removing their arm from the ice water, they made the same estimates as the warm water group. Once the icy water was behind them, even for just minutes, they couldn't quite fathom what it felt like to be cold. On the bright side, there are very few situations in real life where you find yourself with your arm in a bucket of ice water. There's no one way to grieve, and there's no one way to comfort. What helps one person won't help another, and even what helps one day might not help the next. Growing up, I was taught to follow the golden rule. Treat others as you want to be treated. But when someone is suffering, instead of following the golden rule, we need to follow the platinum rule. Treat others as they want to be treated. Take a cue from the person in distress and respond with understanding, or better yet, action. As I was struggling to get back on my feet at home and at work, friends and colleagues would graciously ask, "Is there anything I can do?" They were sincere, but for most of them, I did not have an answer. There were things that would have been helpful, but it was hard for me to ask for them. And some of the requests that came to mind were way too much of an imposition. "Can you make sure my children and I are never left alone on any holiday?" Or impossible. "Can you invent a time machine so we can go back and say goodbye to Dave? Or at least skip Father's Day?" Author Bruce Feiler believes the problem lies in the offer to do anything. He writes that, while well-meaning, this gesture unintentionally shifts the obligation to the aggrieved. Instead of offering anything, just do something. Bruce points to friends who sent packing supplies to someone who was moving out after getting divorced, and others who held a fire shower, a variation on a bridal shower, for a friend who had lost her home. My colleague Dan Levy told me that when his son got sick and he was by his side at the hospital, a friend texted him, "What do you not want on a burger?" Dan appreciated the effort. Instead of asking if I wanted food, he made the choice for me, but gave me the dignity of feeling in control. Another friend texted Dan that she was available for a hug if he needed one, and would be in the hospital lobby for the next hour, whether he came downstairs or not. Specific acts help because instead of trying to fix the problem, they address the damage caused by the problem. Some things in life cannot be fixed. They can only be carried, therapist Megan Devine observes. Even the small act of holding someone's hand can be helpful. Psychologists put teenage girls under stress by asking them to give a spontaneous public speech. When mothers and daughters who were close held hands, the physical contact took away some of the daughter's anxiety. The daughter sweated less, and the physiological stress was transferred to the mothers. This effect resonates with me. 4 days after I found Dave on the gym floor, I gave a eulogy at his funeral. I initially thought I would not be able to get through it, but my children wanted to say something, and I felt that I had to show them I could, too. My sister Michelle stood beside me and gripped my hand tightly. I didn't know about the mother-daughter study then, but her hand in mine gave me courage. Dave was a constant source of strength, a button, not just for me, but for so many. Now where would his friends and family turn for support? A helpful insight comes from psychologist Susan Silk, who devised the ring theory. She suggests writing down the names of people in the center of the tragedy and drawing a circle around them. Then draw a bigger circle around that one and write the names of the people who are next most affected by the event. Keep drawing larger circles for people based on proximity to the crisis. As Silk writes with mediator Barry Goldman, when you are done, you have a kvetching order. Adam drew the first four circles of my ring like this. Adam drew my kids in the center ring. He put Dave's mother, brother, and me in the second ring. Then the third ring had Dave's closest friends and relatives, and my parents and siblings. The fourth ring had Dave's extended family, his colleagues, and my friends. Wherever you are in the circle, offer comfort in and seek comfort out. That means consoling the people who are closer to the tragedy than you are, and reaching out for support from those who are farther removed. Sometimes I sought support from those in the outer rings, but other times I was afraid to accept it. About a week after the funeral, I went to my son's flag football game, still in that deep, early fog that makes it hard to imagine that there even is such a thing as a children's football game. Looking around for a place to sit, I saw so many fathers watching their sons. Dave will never be at another football game again. Just as I was lowering the baseball hat on my head to hide my tears, I spotted my friends Katie and Scott Middick waving me over to a blanket they had laid out on the grass. Earlier, they had offered to attend the game with me, but because they have their own kids to take care of, I told them not to come. I was so grateful they hadn't listened. They sat on either side of me holding my hands. I was there for my son, and they were there for me. Of course, some people just want to curl up after tragedy and hide in their ring. A friend in Los Angeles was utterly lost after her only son died in a car accident. When friends would invite her over to dinner, her initial impulse was always to say no, even though she'd been social in the past. They would press, and she would force herself to say yes. Then the day before, she'd want to cancel but would remind herself, "This is just you trying to run away. You have to go." I was torn by similar conflicting emotions. I hated asking for help, hated needing it, worried incessantly that I was a huge burden to everyone, and yet depended on their constant support. I was suffering from so many insecurities that I almost started a People Afraid of Inconveniencing Others support group, until I realized that all the members would be afraid of imposing on one another and no one would show up. Before, I defined friendships by what I could offer. Career advice, emotional support, suggestions for old and, Dave would have added, bad TV shows to watch. But this all changed, and I needed so much help. I did not just feel like a burden. I truly was a burden. I learned that friendship isn't only what you can give. It's what you're able to receive. Still, as everyone I know who has been through tragedy acknowledges with sadness, there are friends who don't come through as you might hope. A common experience is having friends who decide it's their job to inform grieving pals what they should be doing, and worse, what they should be feeling. A woman I met chose to go to work the day after her husband died because she could not bear to be at home. To this day, she still feels the disapproval of colleagues who said to her, "I'd think you'd be too upset to be here today." You would think, but you just don't know. Grief doesn't share its schedule with anyone. We all grieve differently and in our own time. "It's been 3 months. When are you going to get over this?" one woman said to a friend who miscarried. After the one-year mark, a friend commented to me, "You should be done with that grief thing." "Really? Okay, I'll just put that inconvenient grief thing into a drawer." It's also probably not the most helpful thing to tell someone who's grieving, "You're so depressed and angry, it's just too hard to be around you." That one was said right to my face and preyed upon my worst fear, that it was true. Anger is one of the 5 stages of grief, famously defined by psychiatrist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. In the face of loss, we're supposed to start in denial and move to anger, then to bargaining and depression. Only after we pass through these 4 stages can we find acceptance. But now experts realize that these are not 5 stages. They are 5 states that don't progress in a linear fashion, but rise and fall. Grief and anger aren't extinguished like flames doused with water. They can flicker away one moment and burn hot the next. I struggled with anger. A friend might say the wrong thing, and I would react way too strongly, sometimes lashing out. That is just not helpful. Or bursting into tears. Sometimes I caught myself and apologized right away. But other times I did not realize what I'd done until later, or I imagine at all. Being my friend meant not just comforting me in my grief, but dealing with a level of anger that I'd never felt before and struggled to control. My anger scared me. It made me need the comfort of my friends even more. Like the people in the stress experiment who were consoled by the simple presence of a button, I needed friends who let me know that even if I was difficult to be around, they would not abandon me. Lots of people nicely tried to assure me, "You will get through this." But it was hard to believe them. What helped me more was when people said that they were in it with me. Phil Deutsch did this time and again, saying, "We are going to get through this." When he was away, he sent emails, sometimes with just one line. "You are not alone." One of my childhood girlfriends sent a card that read, "One day she woke up and understood we are all in this together." That card has hung above my desk ever since. I started spending more time with my closest friends and family, who taught me by example how to live the platinum rule. At first it was survival. I could be myself with them, and they were able to absorb and help carry the anguish and anger. Later it became my choice. These shifts in relationships happen to most of us naturally over time. As people mature, they focus on a smaller set of meaningful relationships, and the quality of friendships becomes a more important factor in happiness than the quantity. As the worst of the grief faded, I had to restore balance in my friendships so they weren't one-sided. About a year after Dave died, a friend seemed distracted and upset. I asked what was going on, and she hesitated to tell me. I pressed, and she admitted that she and her husband weren't getting along, but she knew that if she compared her situation to mine, she shouldn't complain. I joked that if my friends couldn't complain about their partners, I wouldn't have any friends. I wanted those close to me to know I was there to help carry their troubles, too. As time passed, I felt especially grateful to my family and friends who continued to check in and show up. On the 6-month anniversary of Dave's death, I sent them a poem, "Footprints in the Sand." It was originally a religious parable, but to me it also expressed something profound about friendship. The poem relates a dream of walking on the beach with God. The storyteller observes that in the sand there are two sets of footprints, except during those periods of life filled with anguish, sorrow, or defeat. Then there is only one set of footprints. Feeling forsaken, the storyteller challenges God. "Why, when I needed you most, have you not been there for me?" The Lord replies, "The years when you have seen only one set of footprints, my child, are when I carried you." I used to think there was one set of footprints because my friends were carrying me through the worst days of my life. But now it means something else to me. When I saw one set of footprints, it was because they were following directly behind me, ready to catch me if I fell. Chapter 4. Self-Compassion and Self-Confidence. Coming to Grips with Ourselves. When Catherine Hoke was 25 years old, she and her husband went on a church trip to Romania to help care for orphans living with HIV. She returned home to New York, committed to doing more for those in need. Then a friend invited her to join a Christian outreach visit to a Texas prison. At the time, Catherine was working in venture capital and noticed that many of the inmates had the same skills and drive as great entrepreneurs. She started flying to Texas on weekends to teach business classes at the prison. She learned that nearly 1 in 4 Americans has a criminal history and 1 in 20 will serve time. While most are eager to work after release, their criminal records make it difficult to get jobs. Catherine felt strongly that these men deserved a second chance. Catherine quit her job and invested all of her savings to create the nonprofit Prison Entrepreneurship Program, which prepares formerly incarcerated men to find employment and start their own businesses. Within 5 years, the program expanded into a statewide organization that graduated 600 students and launched 60 startups. The governor of Texas honored Catherine's work with a public service award. Then Catherine's personal life fell apart. After 9 years of marriage, her husband asked for a divorce unexpectedly and left without saying goodbye. "This was the darkest period of my life," Catherine told us. "In my community, divorce was often seen as a sin. People said God hates divorce." She was afraid to talk about her situation, but there was one group she knew wouldn't judge her, the graduates of her program. Knowing they had felt the sharp sting of prejudice, she turned to them for support. They helped her move out of her house and became her closest confidants. During this emotional time, she lost sight of boundaries and ended up having intimate relationships with more than one of the graduates. The men had been released from prison, so Catherine hadn't broken any laws, but the Texas Department of Criminal Justice determined that her behavior was inappropriate. Catherine was banned from Texas prisons and informed that her program would be banned, too, if she stayed involved. She resigned, and her departure made national headlines as a prison sex scandal. Catherine had spent years urging employers and donors to be open-minded, asking them to imagine how they'd feel if they were defined by their biggest mistake. Suddenly, that was her own life. "I violated my spiritual values. I felt like I was covered in the thickest wall of shame," she told us. "I lost my identity as a leader. I was dead broke financially. I didn't want to live anymore because I felt like I had ruined God's calling for my life." She attempted suicide. Catherine had dedicated herself to helping people get a second chance. She had fostered compassion for ex-offenders. Now she needed to find compassion for someone else. Herself. Self-compassion isn't talked about as much as it should be. Maybe because it's often confused with its troublesome cousins, self-pity and self-indulgence. Psychologist Kristen Neff describes self-compassion as offering the same kindness to ourselves that we would give to a friend. It allows us to respond to our own errors with concern and understanding rather than criticism and shame. Everyone makes mistakes. Some are small but can have serious consequences. We turn our heads for a split second on the playground at just the moment our child falls. We change lanes and hit the car in our blind spot. We make big mistakes, too. Errors of judgment, failures to follow through on commitments, lapses of integrity. None of us can change what we have already done. Self-compassion comes from recognizing that our imperfections are part of being human. Those who can tap into it recover from hardship faster. In a study of people whose marriages fell apart, resilience was not related to their self-esteem, optimism, or depression before divorce, or to how long their relationships or separations had lasted. What helped people cope with distress and move on was self-compassion. For soldiers returning from war in Afghanistan and Iraq, those who were kind to themselves showed significant declines in symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Self-compassion is associated with greater happiness and satisfaction, fewer emotional difficulties, and less anxiety. Both women and men can benefit from self-compassion, but since women tend to be harder on themselves, they often benefit more. As psychologist Mark Leary observes, self-compassion can be an antidote to the cruelty we sometimes inflict on ourselves. Self-compassion often coexists with remorse. It does not mean shirking responsibility for our past. It's about making sure that we don't beat ourselves up so badly that we damage our future. It helps us realize that doing a bad thing does not necessarily make us a bad person. Instead of thinking, "If only I weren't," we can think, "If only I hadn't." This is why confession in the Catholic religion begins with, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned," not, "Forgive me, Father, for I am a sinner." Blaming our actions rather than our character allows us to feel guilt instead of shame. Humorist Irma Bombeck joked that guilt was the gift that keeps giving. Although it can be hard to shake, guilt keeps us striving to improve. People become motivated to repair the wrongs of their past and make better choices in the future. Shame has the opposite effect. It makes people feel small and worthless, leading them to attack in anger or shrink away in self-pity. Among college students, the shame-prone were more likely than the guilt-prone to have drug and alcohol problems. Prisoners who felt ashamed were 30% more likely to commit repeat offenses than those who felt guilty. Elementary and middle school kids who felt shame were more hostile and aggressive, while guilt-prone kids were more likely to diffuse conflicts. Brian Stevenson, a legal activist who leads the Equal Justice Initiative, makes the point that we are all broken by something. We have all hurt someone. He deeply believes that each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. This is what Catherine Hoke came to understand. The first person she sought out was her pastor, who encouraged her to forgive herself and make amends. "The way for me to have compassion for myself was to own my mistakes," she told us. She wrote a frank and remorseful letter to all 7,500 volunteers and supporters of her program admitting what she'd done. More than 1,000 responses poured in from people who thanked Catherine for her honesty and said they believed in her. Many asked what she was doing next. Even though she couldn't see a future for herself, others could. "It was those people who loved me back to life," she recalls. She started to feel self-compassion. Writing to others, and to herself, turned out to be key to Catherine's ability to rebound. For as long as she can remember, Catherine has kept a journal. "Journaling isn't exactly meditating," she told us, "but it helped me quiet myself and reflect. I was able to put words to my feelings and unpack them." Writing can be a powerful tool for learning self-compassion. In one experiment, people were asked to recall a failure or humiliation that had made them feel bad about themselves, ranging from flunking a big test to flopping in an athletic competition to forgetting lines in a play. They drafted a letter to themselves expressing the understanding they would offer to a friend in the same situation. Compared to a control group who wrote just about their positive attributes, those who were kind to themselves were 40% happier and 24% less angry. Turning feelings into words can help us process and overcome adversity. Decades ago, health psychologist Jamie Pennebaker had two groups of college students journal for 15 minutes a day for just 4 days. Some about non-emotional topics and others about the most traumatic experiences of their lives, which included rape, attempted suicide, and child abuse. After the first day of writing, the second group was less happy and had higher blood pressure. This made sense, since confronting trauma is painful. But when Pennebaker followed up 6 months later, the effects reversed, and those who wrote about their traumas were significantly better off emotionally and physically. Since then, more than 100 experiments have documented the therapeutic effect of journaling. It has helped medical students, patients with chronic pain, crime victims, maximum security prisoners, and women after childbirth. It has crossed cultures and countries from Belgium to Mexico to New Zealand. Writing about traumatic events can decrease anxiety and anger, boost grades, reduce absences from work, and lessen the emotional impact of job loss. Health benefits include higher T cell counts, better liver function, and stronger antibody responses. Even journaling for a few minutes a few times can make a difference. You don't have to write for the